Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Hello and welcome along to Unbelievable. I'm Justin Brierley. This is the weekly show as part of Faith Explored here on Premier Christian Radio that brings Christians and non-Christians together for dialogue and debate. Many people discover us every week. Perhaps you discovered us last week following the debate between Jim Al-Khalili and Alistair McGrath. Well, you'll be hearing some of the comments to that programme at the end of today's show. And of course, you can find it online at premierchristianradio.com/Unbelievable. And you can find today's programme there as well. It's great to hear from you wherever you are in the world. So I do hope you'll get in touch and you'll start listening via the podcast, via the internet, and check out some of the great features there as well. Once again, that's premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Well, today we've got a classic debate for you. We're talking about the resurrection.
You're unbelievable.
Well, today on the programme, an ex-Christian revisits the resurrection. Former Christian Ed Atkinson has been a keen listener to Unbelievable ever since he discovered it about a year and a half ago. He's come on a few times since then, and he's back today to discuss the resurrection. It follows on from our Summer of Scripture, in which the case for the resurrection from the so-called minimal facts was debated between Gary Habermas and James Crossley. Well, Tony Costa is our Christian guest today. Tony is Professor of Apologetics at the Toronto Baptist Seminary and teaches in world religions too. He's been on the show before to debate with Islamic guest Shabir Ali on the crucifixion and resurrection. But can he satisfactorily answer any of Ed's questions today? Ed himself says he's very open to the evidence, and if it's true, he wants to know about it. So we're going to be having a really interesting interaction between my guests today. But before I introduce them, a little confession. This isn't the first time we've recorded this programme. This is actually take two for us because as I related a few weeks ago on the programme, there was a technical issue. We were supposed to be airing this debate. Unfortunately, by circumstances that probably were within my control, I managed to delete half of the audio that we'd recorded, which was a great shame for everyone and caused me a bit of a panic when I realised what had happened about a week after we'd recorded. And so we're back to record from scratch. We're going to say, let's pretend that other show didn't happen. But we will, of course, obviously be recording. There'll be a sense of deja vu today on the programme. So I suppose the first thing I should say to you, Ed, is I'm so sorry. But thanks for coming back in.
Thanks. I thought the programme on the Hyde Park and the Ladder was just amazing.
That was the replacement programme, yeah. Yes. But thank you very much. I'm glad you enjoyed what we stuck in at short notice when I realised the mistake. Tony, welcome back to the programme too.
It's a pleasure, Justin, as always.
It's a shame, obviously, we can't have you in the studio as we did the first time round, but we've got you on via Skype from your homeland of Canada. So thanks for joining us again. Let's start with you, though, Ed. You've sort of got the unbelievable bug, haven't you? Not only have you been listening, coming in once or twice to be a guest on the programme, but you've even started a discussion group down in that meets regularly in London.
Yep, near Old Street Station.
Yeah, so that's exciting, and we enjoy hearing the reports of what's been happening and so on, and we'll make sure to keep sending that through for people. But you're a former Christian, still very interested, though, in Christian stuff, obviously. Not something you seem to be able to leave alone.
Yeah.
Why is that?
Well, in some way I could say I don't know, because what our brains force us into, who knows? But if I try to justify myself, certainly these are very interesting and useful, vital questions that Christianity says it answers.
Mm. And it's really since you kind of came across the show that you've developed a real interest in engaging with the evidence for the resurrection, things like that, the apologetics. But, I mean, I think I remember you, again, from our first time we recorded this, saying that if anything were to strike you as important within Christianity, it's the resurrection. I think you said you had studied
well,
quite
even
a bit.
More than that. When I stepped away from the faith and looked at religion from the outside, I looked at everything, in particular this big book from an Oxford library I went to, and it covered all the major religions, and I found it quite depressing, really, because everything was, when you looked at the foundation of a religion, it was just people doing stuff. Mm. So, you know, Muhammad had his visions, or the Buddha sort of starved himself and had enlightenment from that. And there were just ideas and whatever. And the only, well, even Judaism really was in the same category of just ancient myths sort of gathering and people holding, you know, gathering around them or whatever. But then the only spark of interest was the resurrection. That was the reason that Christianity started. Mm. And yet no one really knows exactly what happened.
So you thought, if there's something worth investigating, I guess that would be worth investigating. And so obviously you've had lots of interactions with people both online and stuff. You've come in as well to discuss things like last time, the issue of prayer,
yep,
with
yep.
David Wilkinson. But you came away feeling, well, if at a level below that, what this all seems to hinge on is the issue of did Christ really rise from the dead?
Yes, that's right. And that's what David Wilkinson said in our discussion on prayer, who's... I think it's from Durham, the
That's
St. John's
right.
College Durham
mm.
principal there. So it was vital to him, and it seems completely vital to me, that to get from maybe the philosophers can get to some vague theistic mm. sort of stuff, but to actually have some content and have Christianity, yeah. really the resurrection is the only place to go.
Well, I doubt you disagree with that, Tony. Would that be
no,
fair?
Not at all. Not mm. at all. I think Ed is echoing what the Apostle Paul himself wrote in 1 Corinthians 15, that if Christ is not risen, then the Christian faith is vain, and that we are all false witnesses, and we might as well pack up and go home. So I think he's absolutely right. Christianity stands or falls on the resurrection of Jesus, and I certainly would not be a Christian if Jesus did not rise from the dead.
Tell us a little bit about how you go about presenting the resurrection to people who are sceptical, Tony. We had, as I say, back in the summer, Gary Habermas presenting what he calls the minimal facts hypothesis for the resurrection. Is that something you do as well? And if so, would you like to briefly explain what you mean by that?
Yes, I do that as well. I build up on it. But the minimal facts basically look at five things: the death of Jesus by crucifixion, his honorable burial, his the discovery of the empty tomb, the appearances of Jesus, post-mortem appearances, and then, of course, the origin of the Christian way. And all of these five points are issues that are readily accepted by the vast majority of New Testament scholars. And so I think they do provide some very strong, strong basis for the belief that Jesus was raised from the dead. Of course, many of these scholars will not say that we have a divine miracle here, because as historians, they try to avoid the miraculous. But I think that the best explanation for these five facts is something that God did by raising Jesus from the dead. And that's what the early Christians said happened.
Well, it's great to have you both with us, gentlemen. Great to be able to have a second chance to record today's program as well. And I hope that wherever you are on the faith spectrum, you'll enjoy listening to Ed and Tony have this conversation on the resurrection. Ed is our ex-Christian, revisiting the resurrection. He believed in it at one time, then he lost his faith. Now he's asking, okay, could there be evidence that would bring me back to believing that Jesus Christ rose from the dead? Tony Costa is aiming to try and answer some of the questions today of Ed on the programme. If you'd like to put your own questions in, or your own reflections and comments on today's discussion, you can email unbelievable@premier.org.uk. You can find us online as well, on Twitter and Facebook and all those other methods, at UnbelievableJB via Twitter, facebook.com/UnbelievableJB to drop me a line via the Facebook page and follow what's happening on the show on a regular basis. All the links and more available from the website of the programme, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, let's get into the substance of what we're talking about on the programme today then, gentlemen. And let's start with you, Ed, because I know you've got a very sort of specific idea of how you'd like your the show to progress, the things you want to establish first before we start talking about the minimal facts themselves. So tell us what you'd like to get clear in your mind, first of all.
Yes. Hi, Tony.
Hello there, Ed.
What I'd like to know, really, from you is how strong you feel the evidence for the resurrection is, and in light of this sort of weight that it has to bear. So things like the kind of problems of suffering that you see in Christianity and certain aspects where there's a bit of tension with science, and these sort of things you've got to overcome to believe. And then it's just a big deal anyway. I mean, it's like a big life and death issue. So anything like that, you'd need a good level of evidence.
You're saying that to believe in Christianity and the fact that it is, you know, your eternal destiny rests on what you believe about Christ.
Yes,
you need that resurrection needs to support a lot of weight.
Yes,
it's not it's not an inconsequential thing in that sense. You're saying, whether you believe it or not.
So
your question to Tony then is, can it support all that weight on it in terms of the evidence that there is for the resurrection?
Yes, that's right. And what you think, Tony, is the force of it? I mean, would it stand up in court, for example?
Well, in terms of standing up in court, I mean, there have been a number of events or cases in history where people went out to disprove the resurrection. I'm thinking of people like Simon Greenleaf, who founded the Greenleaf School of Law in the United States, who went out to disprove the resurrection accounts from a legalistic forensic point of view, and he came to the conclusion that Jesus was actually raised from the dead by the evidence that he found through his research. He was set out to destroy it and actually was ended up being convinced by it. I can think of other people like Frank Morrison and just others who have looked at the evidence from a skeptical, atheistic point of view and later were convinced by it. So I think that the minimal facts, that if we really look at them very seriously, that if we try to explain them, the best explanation that I find is that it's what the early Christians said, that God raised Jesus from the dead. I think all competing hypotheses, I think, fall by the wayside.
Do you subscribe to that that view? I think, was it Hume responsible for it, that extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence, Ed? Is that something you would say of the resurrection?
Yes, I would.
And hence has a greater burden to bear because the claim is extraordinary. You must have more evidence than you would need for a normal natural event.
Yes, that's right.
Do you take that view, Tony?
Not necessarily. I know David Hume is famous for that claim, but if you look at the New Testament Gospels, all they tell us, again, is that the disciples followed Jesus. They saw Jesus alive. Their master was summarily arrested and then executed by the Roman prefect Pontius Pilate. And then later they claimed that his tomb was empty and that they saw him alive again. I don't think there's something necessarily extraordinary about seeing Jesus alive and then he dies, he's out of the picture, and then they see him alive again. So to call for extraordinary evidence, I think, from Hume's perspective, I think goes beyond what the New Testament actually says. The New Testament basically says, this man Jesus was dead, and this man Jesus is now alive. And the explanation that the disciples provide is that God raised him from the dead.
And that's all just ordinary?
Well, the event itself is not ordinary. The event absolutely is extraordinary. But the evidence that we find for the resurrection of Jesus, those minimal facts, we have to have an explanation for them.
So
what is the alternate explanation that we can provide for those five facts?
I'm still trying to establish what the level of evidence is. Is it just ordinary, or is it, say, beyond reasonable doubt?
Well, I think it's ordinary because, as I pointed out, if I saw you alive, Ed, and you claim to be the Messiah, the Son of God, and so forth, and then you were executed and put to death, and then you were alive 3 days later, 4 days later. There's nothing extraordinary about my experience. What is extraordinary is the fact that you were raised from the dead. And so, as I pointed out, to say that the disciples saw Jesus alive again and then claimed that God raised him from the dead, I think it's a pretty good testimony to what happened.
Yeah, I don't really understand why you're you're not wanting to nail your colours to the mast and say, yes, I can show this beyond reasonable doubt.
I think it is. If you look at the five facts again, we have to provide an alternate explanation for those facts.
Okay,
and
great.
I'm willing to hear if you have any alternate explanations for those five minimal facts. But the best explanation that we have, in my opinion, is that God raised Jesus from the dead, because dead people do not regularly rise on a natural basis.
Lovely.
Okay. Well, where have we got to then? Obviously, Tony says, okay, we're going on what people reported. We're going on these facts, these generally established facts of, as shared by the majority of scholars about the events surrounding the purported resurrection. And his view is the best explanation is the one that the disciples and apostles gave. Jesus Christ rose from the dead. You would need to give me an alternative explanation and would have to weigh that, against the resurrection hypothesis.
Okay, that's fine. Ed. Yep, great. Okay, so I'll go down your five facts, Tony. Jesus died, yes, I'll go with that. The honourable burial, I dispute. The empty tomb, I dispute. The appearances, I agree with. And the origin of the Christian way, I agree with.
So, okay, so three of them you're saying you agree with. You think you're happy to accept that it's an established historical fact that Jesus died by crucifixion.
Yep.
You're happy to accept that followers of Jesus Christ reported experiences of the resurrected Christ. And that's important to distinguish. You're not saying you believe they did experience the resurrected Christ. You're happy to believe that they believed that they
experienced.
Yes,
that's right.
Okay.
When James Crossley and Gary Habermas discussed this just recently, that was the conclusion they came to.
And that the Christianity grew in a kind of unprecedented way and so on, the start of the Christian church. But there's two facts that you take issue with. So before we kind of get to discuss those two, Tony, do you have to have all five facts agreed on by the person opposite you in order to be able to make the case for the resurrection? If these are generally established historical facts, should Ed just be obliged by kind of the argument from authority to accept that, well, you're not a historical scholar, Ed, so just go with the majority opinion? What's your take on that, Tony?
Well, I think that all of these five points, they all logically follow from each other. The burial of Jesus, of course, is the confirmation that he was dead, that he was clinically dead. And the honorable burial itself has been admitted by scholars such as the late John E.T. Robinson of Cambridge University. He calls it the earliest and best attested facts about Jesus. And Rudolf Bultmann as well agreed on that.
These are not, if you like, your standard, evangelical scholars. These are quite skeptical scholars.
Very left-wing, very liberal, very liberal critics of the New Testament and so forth. But they've been convinced by the multiple attestation that we find in the gospel accounts about the honorable burial of Jesus. And then again, the empty tomb, as Jacob Kramer, an Austrian specialist on the resurrection, says that the empty tomb narratives are based on solid historical evidence. And then the postmortem appearances. I mean, Bart Ehrman himself has admitted that the Christian faith began with not just the empty tomb, but also the appearances of Jesus to the disciples. Now, Bart Ehrman doesn't believe that, but he says that the evidence pushes us in that direction. And so I think that these five points are very crucial because they're all linked together, which leads us to the conclusion that this is the origin of the Christian way.
Yeah. Well, what's your problem then, specifically, Ed, with the honorable burial as one of the facts, and the empty tomb, the fact of an empty tomb being discovered?
Well, on the empty tomb, Gary Habermas's famous sort of survey, where, in fact, I think he mentioned it on the show, that about a quarter to a third of scholars don't think the empty tomb happened, and about a quarter of scholars are not of the conservative persuasion. So the number of scholars who don't go with the empty tomb and those who are kind of not persuaded to be in evangelical colleges and conservative theological seminaries and stuff, they're roughly the same,
right?
Or even a few.
So you're saying basically everyone who doesn't take the empty tomb view is basically who the people who aren't conservative evangelical sort of scholars in their leanings. Therefore, there isn't this broad consensus on that particular fact.
Yeah, that's
as
what
far
Gareth says.
Concerned.
Yeah, that's what Gareth says.
I mean, do you?
But that wasn't answering your question.
Yeah. Well, let's answer that though itself, because I think it's an important point there, Tony. I mean, you've labelled the empty tomb as a minimal fact because it's agreed on by the majority of New Testament scholars, and Ed's here saying, but they're all evangelicals, the ones who agree on that one. The liberals don't agree.
Well, not necessarily. That's actually not true. There are liberal scholars in the field who would affirm the empty tomb as well. Not just on the Christian side of things, but there are two prominent Jewish theologian scholars who also believed in the empty tomb. Dr. Pinchas Lapid, who used to teach at the Hebrew University in Israel, wrote a book on the resurrection of Jesus, A Jewish Perspective, where he clearly argues that that the empty tomb was a historical fact and claims that the God of Israel raised Jesus from the dead. The other one was Geza Vermesh, who actually, I believe, taught at Oxford. He was one of the leading experts on the Dead Sea Scrolls. And Dr. Vermesh argued that the evidence for the empty tomb in the Gospels is a historical sound affirmation.
Just briefly, what would be the evidence for the empty tomb? Why would the scholars who do say that's an established fact say hold to that so firmly?
Well, part of it is that the empty tomb story is part of the old pre-Mark and Passion narrative. The pre-Mark and Passion narrative is believed to have been the source material that Mark, the earliest gospel writer, derived a lot of his Passion story from. And included in that pre-Mark and Passion narrative was the empty tomb story. And this source is believed to have originated around 37 AD, about 4 years after Jesus' death and resurrection. There's also the old tradition in 1 Corinthians 15, 3-5, where Paul quotes an early creed where he mentions the death of Christ, his burial, and then his resurrection. And it's these points, these early attestations, these early references that have convinced scholars that the empty tomb story is a very early story and part of the fabric of the Easter narrative.
So what's your problem with the empty tomb yourself, Ed?
Okay, well, of course, the creed in 1 Corinthians 15 mentions Jesus being buried, but doesn't mention how. so we don't know there was even a tomb. And therefore, if it was empty, it might be just in people's minds, a sort of grave in the ground.
So you don't see that as supporting the case?
Not 1 Corinthians 15, it's just neutral.
What about this idea that it is part of the sort of pre-Mark and very early sort of, you know, narrative of the Easter events, the empty tomb?
Well, I've no idea how anyone can date a document that doesn't exist. We just think it, well, some scholars, not even all scholars, think it might have been behind Mark, but no one knows. No one knows really where it ended, if it ended with the burial or the empty tomb.
What makes you question the idea of an empty tomb?
Okay, yeah, I'll get done. I've got a list of points here. Firstly, the idea of a burial in a tomb is not what you'd expect from the background historical knowledge of how the Romans and the Jews dealt with
crucified
victims.
Right? Yep. What did happen to them normally? Sort of thrown into an open grave or something?
Or
like that?
Perhaps more likely left to the wild
scavengers.
Animals. Yes,
yeah.
Yes, right. But then, if we believe 1 Corinthians 15, and I've got no reason to doubt it, Jesus was buried.
Okay. So you would take Paul's words there, meaning he was buried in a grave as opposed to a tomb?
Well, I take that, but I've got no reason to. He just says he was buried.
Right. And that doesn't sound to you like placed in a tomb. That sounds like earth shoveled on top of him sort of thing.
The word could cover both.
So it would cover both.
Yeah.
But specifically doesn't mention the tomb.
That's right,
what you're saying.
Yeah, that's right.
Do you want to give us one or two more and then we'll allow Tony to respond?
There's really good explanations for why we might expect that myth of an empty tomb to arise. The whole point about how the empty tomb, the tomb was never venerated.
You'd expect it to be? If there was an empty tomb, they would sort of turn it into a shrine of some kind.
Yeah, people would know where it was for sure.
Okay.
It would be. I was shown the grave of Tessa the D'Urbervilles by a local farmer. But Tessa Thurville's never existed, and in the Thomas Hardy story, she was in the grave for 20 minutes.
Right.
But still,
nevertheless,
it was a venerated
place. There's still a Tessa Thurville's grave.
Yeah, it's
right.
There.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
The veneration point, then how Mark tells the story. Mark, of course, is the first evidence anything, and how he tells the story is highly strange. That suggests to me that it's a myth. And then just the whole Joseph Arimathea is a troublesome character.
Okay. Lot there. So we're probably not going to have time to cover much ground before we have to go to a break, Tony. Do you want to just say something quickly and we'll come back to you after a quick break?
Yes. Well, the creed that Paul cites is not Paul's own creed. James Dunn says that this creed started proliferating in the early Christian movement months after Jesus' death and resurrection. So that the creed that Paul is citing is something that he got from another source. He says, what I received, I passed on to you. And the only source he would have gotten that from was Jesus' original disciples. Galatians 1 and 2, Paul says he visited Peter and spent 14 days with Peter in Jerusalem. And as Professor Dodd once put it, they weren't spending the 2 weeks talking about the weather. And so Paul would have gotten this information from the early disciples. Secondly, I think Ed has to realize he's dealing with the first century Jewish milieu here. The Jews believed that resurrection meant the raising of the dead body from the grave, which would imply an empty tomb being left behind. And Josephus tells us that there were cases where people were given honorable burials who were crucified. Josephus speaks of seeking permission from the authorities to bury some of his friends and even rescue some of them from the cross. So having Jesus buried in a tomb, a private tomb like that of Joseph of Arimathea, is totally in keeping with what we know about first century documentation.
Even if it was unusual, it's not unknown, you're saying.
No, it's not unknown. We do have examples of that. And there's no ad hoc or contrived attempt here on the part of the gospel writers. The women coming to the tomb is an embarrassing situation. Women had no legal status, according to Josephus, in a court of law as testimonies. And so, and the ending of Mark, the reason why Mark ends it the way he does is specifically because Mark uses irony as a literary device throughout his gospel to catch the attention of his readers. And so there's nothing really contrived here or ad hoc.
We're going to go to a break and we'll allow Ed to come back in a moment's time. You're listening to an ex-Christian revisiting the resurrection. Ed Atkinson says, I'm a former Christian, but I'm happy to be convinced if you can show me the evidence, Tony, about the resurrection. Tony is our Christian guest. Tony Costa, Professor of Apologetics at the Toronto Baptist Seminary, and in conversation with Ed today. You're listening to Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley, as part of Faith Explored here on Premier Christian Radio. And we'll be back in a moment's time.
Premier Christianity, for cutting-edge commentary and encouraging stories. Tackling the big issues to help you live out your faith.
We talk affairs of the heart in the latest edition, following the hacking of Ashley Madison, the website dedicated to infidelity. Also, A Life Less Ordinary. Rachel and Andrew Wilson share their experience parenting children with special needs and how to cope spiritually with the life you never expected. Plus, apps to get you reading scripture again, Bible scholar Tom Wright, comedian Paul Carenza, and much more.
For your free copy of Premier Christianity, visit premierchristianity.com/freesample.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to the second part of Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley. Today we're talking about the resurrection. We're revisiting a debate that we held over the summer on the evidence for the resurrection. If you want to find more programmes of a similar nature on science, faith, history, scripture, ethics, philosophy, theology, all kinds of things, why not visit our website, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable, and you can find loads of stuff to get your teeth into. There's also the ways to get in contact there. You can email unbelievable@premier.org.uk. If you want to tell me something about today's show, say what you agreed with, disagreed with, and so on, you can also, of course, do that via Twitter and Facebook. All the links from premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. And we'll be hearing some of your feedback to the show towards the end of today's programme. And I'm joined on the show today by Ed Atkinson. He's a former Christian and
Alexander. He's the one who's asking the tough questions about the resurrection of Tony Costa, who's a Canadian apologist, and he's been defending what's called the minimal facts hypothesis.
Coming back to you then, Ed, you've heard some of the responses there from Tony. He just doesn't see that actually the fact that, yes, usually crucified criminals weren't given an honourable burial may be true, but there are also clear examples stated by Josephus where exceptions were made to the case. And you can imagine that the case of Jesus might very well be an important exception because of the nature of the way he was tried and executed and so on. I could imagine, and the fact that he was such a significant character. So to me, I think Tony's got quite a strong point there, that if anyone was due to maybe be the exception to that rule, it would have been Jesus. You've got a problem as well with Joseph of Arimathea, so maybe we should talk about that as well and see what Tony has to say. But carry on.
Well, just quickly clarifying on the 1 Corinthians 15 creed that you've mentioned, really that has nothing to say on the burial at all, just on the appearances, which I am subscribing to anyway. So we'll hopefully come on to the appearances much later, but that's not relevant to the empty tomb.
Do you agree with that, Tony? It's not relevant to the empty tomb, 1 Corinthians 15?
Well, I think it is, because Paul, you see, was a Pharisee, and the Pharisees believed in the resurrection. And resurrection, I think we need to define that term resurrection. Resurrection means the raising up of the dead, and that implies leaving behind an empty tomb. And so for Paul to say that he believed in the resurrection of Jesus, but there was no empty tomb, would be an oxymoronic statement on his part. Resurrection implies the raising of the dead.
I think you're really missing the point here. What I'm saying is that we don't know that it was a tomb rather than a shallow grave or trench grave or something like that.
Well, I would disagree, Ed, because we do have multiple attestation in the gospel accounts that there was a tomb and it was owned by Joseph. And Joseph let the body of Jesus be placed therein. So the multiple attestation in Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, even the book of Acts, I think is clear evidence.
Is your problem, Ed, that the Apostle Paul never mentions an empty tomb, therefore that's very odd? You know, why wouldn't he, if that was what was well known as the fact of the time? Is that the main problem you have?
No, I suppose the problem I'm having is that the strong historical basis for 1 Corinthians 15, Tony is trying to use to establish an empty tomb. I agree with a strong historical basis, but it doesn't establish an empty tomb. It establishes an empty something.
Yes, and we're not told whether that's a tomb or a shallow grave.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
What's your response, Tony?
Well, again, I think that we have to ask the question: where did Paul get the creed from? Where was its origins? And I think all scholars, I don't know any scholar that denies that Paul got that from the early Jerusalem disciples. And if he got that information from the early Jerusalem disciples, what we know about what the early Jerusalem disciples believed was that Jesus' tomb was empty and that they saw him alive again. And so if you follow Paul's creed, he says Jesus died, was buried, was raised, and appeared. Basically what Paul does is he gives us the gospel narratives in capsule form. That is to say, he shrinks down the narratives of the Gospels, which you find is crucifixion, burial, resurrection, and then appearances.
We might have to move beyond this. Obviously, Ed, you don't feel it warrants support for the tomb hypothesis, but let's move beyond it. I mean, do you want to talk about Joseph of Arimathea before we...
No, we were still deep on, say, this thing with the women at the tomb and Mark that... Tony was starting to come back on. So the way that Mark finishes his gospel is that the women fled from the tomb and said nothing to anyone. So trembling and bewildered, the women went out and fled from the tomb. They said nothing to anyone because they were afraid. And that's the end of Mark's gospel. And so... it seems that Mark is bending over backwards to tell us something that we haven't heard before. He's using witnesses who are women, who we all agree were, in that sort of cultural setting, were considered less
Their testimony was worth a lot less.
Yes, that's right. And then not only is their testimony worth less, but actually they don't use it. They don't say anything to anyone.
In as much as, obviously, I guess Mark, to be able to tell the story, would have had to have, they would have had to have told someone eventually, even if that's where he does end it. I mean, I'd just be interested.
As Tony said, it could be a sort of rhetorical device or something.
Right.
But what it seems to me is that people believed in the resurrection based on the appearances. People imagined the grave had to be empty. And one, for reasons we'll come on to, as why they thought there was a tomb rather than a grave.
Mm.
They then thought, okay, there must have been some kind of way that it was discovered to be empty. And so as they tell the story, it kind of appeared.
Right. Okay.
It's not quite Chinese. It's sort of urban myth is the thing I'd say.
So, Tony, what's your response to some of these things? I mean, Mark's Gospel's ending is a bit curious because it does end rather suddenly. Some people have suggested, hey, maybe the ending got lost at some point. Maybe there was, more of a tidy ending that Mark had than just suddenly the women, they went and told no one, as it were. What's your take on the way Mark ends his gospel and whether it does militate against the idea of an empty tomb?
Well, I think that, as I indicated before, I doubt that the ending of Mark was lost. I mean, as you know, there are alternate variant readings that crept into the text later precisely because of that. I think that Mark deliberately ends it that way because throughout the Gospel of Mark, it's a very short gospel, but the Gospel of Mark is filled with irony. And the whole idea is that Mark leaves the reader with this story. These women run away, they're scared, and they're seized with fear. They say nothing to no one, which, as you rightly pointed out, if they had said nothing to no one, we wouldn't be talking about this right now. But it's, I think, the irony is, what will you do with this risen Jesus? What will you, the reader, do with this information? Now, the other issue here, Justin, I think Ed has to, I think, realize, is that the rising of Jesus, it was not something that the early Christians were expecting. The early Christians were all Jews. The belief was that the resurrection would take place at the end of the world, an eschatological event. In other words, the resurrection of Jesus within time, as we see it in the Gospels, was not something that was part of Judaism. And so this was not ad hoc, as I pointed out. They did not contrive to make up the story of the resurrection of Jesus. And so it was not something they were expecting. They go to the tomb to finish up the funeral rites of anointing the body, and they find it empty. And so it's not that they invented the story and they just patched it together. This is something that goes contrary to what we know about Jewish beliefs about the end of the world and the resurrection.
And from that point of view, by what some scholars sometimes call the criterion of embarrassment or dissimilarity, they wouldn't have made that up if it was, if they were trying to concoct a story, because it would have been much harder to make people believe that, to believe in a theology that contradicted commonly
Correct.
Held Jewish theology, I guess, is the
Correct.
Is the point. Yeah, it's another kind of point, it's another supporting argument among the many that are often used for the resurrection there, Ed. I don't know if you want to carry on with talking about the Mark's Gospel or
move well, the key point about the women is that along with the way they said nothing to anybody, Mark is saying to Christians who have heard of the resurrection but not heard of the empty tomb, say, well, this happened, but also I'm explaining why you've not heard of it before.
So you're kind of making a sort of a deduction that you think this story was going around, but Mark's kind of inventing an empty tomb in order to sort of try and join some of the dots here about how this Jesus would have come back. Now, if that's the case, I guess the next question is, why did he make women the discoverers of this empty tomb if, as we're all agreed on, it seems, that wouldn't have been a good way of convincing people about the authenticity of this story?
Yes, just to sort of clarify, I'm not saying anyone's been deceitful. Urban myths sort of appear not through deceit. They just sort of, people tell things and they add.
But you are. I thought you were saying that Mark did invent it.
An easy way of talking about it, to say how it fits his purpose to have those, have it explained in that way.
But it doesn't fit his purpose to have women, does it?
Yes, it does. Because he wants to explain what should have been a completely public event. If Jesus died, was buried in a tomb, very visible, and then it was found to be empty, the whole of Jerusalem would know about it. If it was Mark writing, it would be how he writes early on in the Gospels, how the people were amazed and said, what can this be? That kind of narrative would be there at the empty tomb. But actually it's described as a very personal, private event, which is not what you'd expect at all. And the reason for that is that when the Gospel was first pronounced, it was just based on the appearances. And then as time went on, people wondered, well, as Tony says, they believed in physical resurrection. So there must have been an empty tomb somehow. And then the story developed. But then as people wanted to proclaim it, it had to be in an environment where, hang on a minute, how come we've never heard this before?
What you're saying is Mark, if you like, for want of a better word, invents the story in such a way that because he's putting women there and they're not going and telling you, and that kind of explains why no one had heard this story up till now.
And then when Matthew and Luke and everyone else talk about it, they have heard about it, so the silence of the women is taken out of the story.
Right. What do you make of all this then, Tony? It's an interesting thesis.
Well, it is interesting, but it still doesn't answer the question why Mark would choose women, which would be the sure way to basically shoot himself in the foot. And no one would pay attention to his testimony at all, because women were not credible witnesses in the first century systems of law. And so we have to ask the question, if Mark wanted to make this persuasive case, why would he jeopardize his whole account by introducing women? And now, I know Ed says the appearances, he's convinced by the appearances, but again, as Dr. Raymond Brown pointed out many years ago, he said, listen, we have to deal with the fact. Why did they use the language of resurrection? I mean, we can have appearances, like angelic appearances, but when we start saying resurrection, we are saying that someone who was once dead is now alive. And so you cannot have the appearances without the resurrection, because the appearances imply that the dead Jesus has come back to life and he has appeared to his followers. So this is why those points that I mentioned are so integrated, they're so importantly linked to one another, that to divorce them is just to break down the whole system.
Okay. Let's move on to something else, because I feel we've done a good amount of to and fro on that one. Okay, what was the other issue you had with? So there was honourable burial and empty tomb, obviously. These are the issues that you've primarily got, Ed.
So those were the two issues of Tony's five that I'm not going with. We've talked about the appearances a lot, but I think that's a good place to go to now.
Okay.
In terms of Tony's challenged me to come up with an alternative explanation for what we've got.
Yeah, so what we're saying then, I suppose, is Tony's view is, he differs obviously with you on the issue of whether the empty tomb and the honourable burial are established facts. He believes that they are perfectly adequately established. You don't believe they are. But nonetheless, let's say, give him the benefit of the doubt or whatever, and say, let's say that these are all established, or the majority of them were. You still don't think, even if all five went through, that the resurrection of Jesus is the best explanation for those five facts. Am I getting you right here, Ed?
I've never even thought that one through, because I'm so unconvinced by the empty tomb and everything. So the three facts we're left with that we all agree to is that death, appearances,
start of the church.
Yeah, that's
okay.
Right.
I mean, would you be willing to say, Tony, that even if you didn't, even if you weren't granted the honourable burial and empty tomb, do you think just on the basis of the three facts, you Ed still ought to believe the resurrection is the best explanation?
Well, no, because the word resurrection would not fit the description of what we find. Resurrection, again, in a first century Jewish setting, meant the raising of the dead body from the grave. And so to speak of an appearance of someone who died and have their body still interred, that would not be resurrection. So we still have to get around why the early Christians employed the vocabulary of resurrection to describe the post-mortem state of Jesus. We still haven't answered that.
No, I haven't.
D- Do you want to answer that first?
Yep, great.
And then we'll get your other explanations that you could give.
Yes. Well, I think that resurrection belief in first century Judaism was very messy. So we all know the Sadducees didn't believe it at all. Herod said Jesus is John the Baptist resurrected, and the people did as well. And when Jesus asked Peter, "Who do you say that I am?" That passage as well has people saying, "Yeah, you're."
Peter says, "Some say you're John the Baptist, some say Elisha."
Yeah, that's right.
And then Jesus says, "Who do you say I am?" And he says, "You are the Christ, the Son of the Living
God." And then when James Crossley was on the show, he talked about some Maccabees expecting a resurrection. I don't know what he's referring to, but that was another case of.
So you think that there was enough sort of folklore-ish other alternative explanations, sort of views of resurrection going around, that it's not firmly established what that the disciples would have necessarily associated a resurrection with a physical resurrected person?
They probably would have done. Obviously, it's such a mess, we don't know. But the point that people try to make is that resurrection was only understood at the end of the age.
Mm.
And that's why you can't think just a hallucination or something would produce resurrection belief. But that's what I'm saying. It's all messy enough to really, you can't say that.
Okay, why do you feel that it isn't as messy as Ed says, that it really would have been odd for them to speak of a resurrected Jesus if it hadn't happened?
Well, I think I don't think resurrection was messy at all. I mean, the fact that Herod thought that Jesus was John the Baptist returned from the dead demonstrates my point, that he actually thought that Jesus was John resurrected back from the dead. And so I think Ed is confusing ideas of immortality of the soul, the Platonic idea of immortality of the soul, with that of resurrection. I mean, the Sadducees didn't believe in the resurrection. That's why they were sad, you see?
And that old one.
That old chestnut. So every time we see resurrection, we're talking about a body, a person who's died, and a person who's been raised from the dead. So we still have to answer the answer why it is that the New Testament uses the language of resurrection to explain what happened to Jesus.
Are we getting anywhere, Ed?
Yeah, I just don't get that point at all, really.
Well, why don't they talk about the soul of Jesus simply existing in an immortal state, or why don't they talk about the translation of Jesus into heaven, like what happened with Elijah or Enoch? They consistently say that Jesus was raised from the dead. And so to a first century Jew, a resurrection meant a return of the person, the body, back to life.
Yeah. Well, so okay.
Why would they use that language if Jesus' body was still rotting in the grave?
Well, they imagined it wasn't, but they didn't, weren't able to test it.
If they imagined that it was, wouldn't that be the death blow to the early Christian movement? All the opponents would have to do is produce the corpse of Jesus, and that would be the end of Christianity.
Yeah, but the opponents weren't aware of it until 7 weeks later, and the corpse of Jesus would have been...
No, not at all. Matthew 28 points out that there was an investigation into the claim that Jesus's body was no longer in the tomb, and the religious leaders bribed the soldiers or the guards of the tomb to basically say that the disciples came and stole the body of Jesus in the night. So we have an early Jewish explanation, but if you notice, they do not deny the empty tomb. They simply give a naturalistic explanation that the body was raided from the tomb.
Yeah, well, the guard story is one of the flakiest aspects of the resurrection
It survives into this day in Jewish apologetics against the resurrection.
Yeah, but the story in Matthew is deeply flaky.
I don't think so. I think it's very normal and natural because it gives a naturalistic explanation to what happened.
Okay, so just briefly, I was going to do this more often, but to sort of step right back to where we started, you're establishing things beyond reasonable doubt. And so you're relying on a story in Matthew that most scholars are deeply wary of as to establish the resurrection.
No, not at all. Not at all. I didn't say that I'm resting all my claims on Matthew. The reason why they find it suspicious in Matthew is because it's only mentioned in Matthew. But I don't think that's an argument against the fact that it's very plausible that when the empty tomb story was being circulated, it's very plausible that the religious leaders would not want this to be seen as an evidence of the resurrection. And so they would say that the body was stolen from the tomb. And that's exactly what we find in Jewish polemics against Christianity, is that the disciples of Jesus stole his body and then invented the resurrection.
Yeah, sure. Well, as the resurrection was preached and it included an empty tomb narrative, then the go-to response in that environment was the disciples stole the body, because we know that body stealing was a thing.
But why the disciples would steal the body, concoct a lie that Jesus was risen, which would be against everything they believed in. And Jesus being crucified was really the greatest insult to Jesus's memory, because a crucified criminal, according to the law of Moses, was accursed. Whoever hangs on a tree is accursed by God. So the last thing you'd want to think is that someone who hung on a tree was the Messiah.
The disciples weren't making up this story. It was made up by their opponents.
Yes, the story that Jesus's body was robbed from the tomb. Yes. But that's my point, Ed, that the disciples were saying Jesus was risen from the dead, and their response was, no, he wasn't. You stole his body from the tomb. Mm. But they're not denying the empty tomb. That's my point. Even the religious leaders acknowledged the tomb was empty.
I mean, let's maybe move on to talking about other viable hypotheses.
Yeah,
and I think we do want to get there before we spend all our time debating the empty tomb. Because, okay, your view is, A, you're not happy that Tony has satisfactorily established that beyond reasonable doubt these various features around the resurrection. But in any case, you think you could, you know, come up with a plausible alternative, say, to the resurrection account, explanation for all these facts
that's
anyway.
Right.
What would... Give us an example.
Okay, so the facts that... I need to agree on, so that we agree on, and I need to respond to, are the appearances.
Mm-hmm.
And the appearances, as Tony is saying, were as such of impact for people to believe that Jesus was physically resurrected rather than just an ethereal spirit in heaven. So that's my challenge, as it were. And when you look at it in 1 Corinthians 15, it's all described as things in people's heads. It's not there's no the physical aspect of it. And
what do you mean by it's all described as things in people's heads?
Well, when you have Luke describing Jesus eating fish and people touching his side, that is very physical.
Yeah.
In 1 Corinthians 15, it's this word opthe, Jesus appeared to everyone. All the appearances are the same word.
But isn't
that's of Paul.
But this 1 Corinthians 15 we've been talking about, Jesus died, was buried, and rose again, and so on.
Yeah.
Sounds physical to me. Are you saying that could have been spiritual language in some way?
Died, buried, physical, and then rose again is based on the appearances. So the actual experiences people had, maybe they saw Jesus die, then maybe they saw him being buried, but they saw him alive as an appearance, and that is a vision. So Paul talks about the heavenly vision in Acts.
Yes. Well, Paul's experience obviously was a visionary experience.
Yes,
of Jesus.
That's right. And that same word is used.
And you think that probably the others were as well?
Yes. I would say there's a whole mixture of things going on behind that, based on the way that us as humans have very poor kind of truth establishing powers. we're easily tricked, and our brains let us down all over the place. So I've got my list.
Okay. So you're going to give us the alternative. What I'm hearing is the alternative explanation is simply that it was a sort of hallucination of some kind, like that.
Yeah. Hallucinations don't cover group experiences. I think hallucinations are individual events.
Okay, just a minute left in this section of the program to respond, Tony, and then we'll be able to let you carry on responding in the final part of the program. So, why for you isn't the hallucination hypothesis a satisfactory one?
Well, simply because we have to understand that. As we pointed out briefly there, hallucinations, I can grant individuals. But we have group settings where groups of people saw Jesus alive again. Paul makes mention of that too in his list, as does the gospel accounts as well. But hallucinations do not answer the question of resurrection, because again, resurrection is the language of the dead rising from the grave. And so to claim that they saw Jesus alive again and his body is still interred in the tomb, that makes Jesus no different than anyone else who has died and has presumably been seen again. So hallucination theories have been actually chucked out the window already a long time ago. Scholars don't accept that as a viable explanation. But I would ask Ed, why is it that he's convinced by the hallucination theory, but he's not convinced by the other facts that I just mentioned? Why this theory does he find convincing over the others?
Okay, I'm not convinced by anything. I'm saying you need to establish a resurrection beyond reasonable doubt. And there are these other issues that establish very reasonable doubt. Hallucinations is one of them. When people have hallucinations, the scientific literature tells us, American Psychic Association Diagnostic and Statistical Manual on Mental Disorders, they describe it as a sensory perception that has the compelling sense of reality of a true perception, but that occurs without external stimulation. So if someone experiences that, they truly, truly think that Jesus is with them, as much as if Jesus really was physically sitting next to them.
We'll come back to you, Tony, to respond in a moment's time. Were the resurrection appearances just hallucinations in the minds of the disciples? Ed says that's just as valid an explanation for the minimal facts as the physical resurrection of Jesus. And we need more evidence, he says, to establish a physical resurrection. So Tony Costa will continue to respond in the final part of today's programme. Unbelievable. This is the place where we get these kinds of conversations going week in, week out between believers and non-believers. Hope you can join us for the final part of today's programme in just a moment's time.
Welcome back to the final part of today's Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley, brought to you as part of Faith Explored here on Premier Christian Radio. And don't forget that straight after Unbelievable, to conclude Faith Explored, you can hear The Profile, where we sit down with a leading Christian in some walk of life. Don't forget also that this show and Faith Explored is also brought to you in association with Premier Christianity Magazine. That's the magazine that I'm the senior editor of. And if you'd like a free sample copy of the latest edition, you can simply ask for one by visiting premierchristianity.com/free sample. Our November edition has just landed, and you might want to get yourself a copy of that. Some really interesting stuff in the latest edition. We'll be hearing some of your feedback in a moment's time to what's been going on recently on the programme. And next week on the show, we're going to be opening up the whole issue of intelligent design. Perhaps you'd like to get in touch about that next week. I know that that often provokes a lot of interest. We'll be hearing from Jonathan McClatchy, who's made quite a name for himself in the intelligent design community, and from an atheist, Corey Markham. So you can hear their discussion on that issue at the same time next week. Hope you can come back for that. For the moment, let's get back into the final part of today's discussion.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
So concluding today's discussion, an ex-Christian revisiting the resurrection, Ed Atkinson, our ex-Christian, who's been asking the tough questions of Tony Costa, our Christian guest, on whether the sort of facts surrounding the resurrection story all add up. We've had quite a lot of to and fro on things like whether there really was an empty tomb, whether that's a historically established fact and so on. But now we've got to the point of Ed, you know, offering an alternative explanation, saying, why couldn't this be just as good an explanation as a miracle happening? And Tony responding in like manner. So, Tony, in that last section, Ed essentially putting the challenge to you that, you know, the psychologists say that hallucinations are just as real to the people who are experiencing them as you know, a physically present person and so on. And although he's, and I don't think Ed's saying that's what he believes happens, but he's saying here's another explanation, which to my mind seems just as plausible, if not more plausible, than the resurrection hypothesis. So what's your comeback on this?
Well, I would say once again, that does not explain the group appearances where groups of people saw Jesus. Paul cites the apostles saw him, James and the apostles. He talks about the 12. He talks about the 500 brethren who saw him as well. So the hallucination theory cannot stand the weight of the evidence of the plural witnesses. The other problem, again, is that the hallucination theory does not explain the language of resurrection that the early Christians used. And also, it does not explain Paul's conversion to the Christian faith. Paul was a persecutor of the church. There would be no reason why he would hallucinate Jesus appearing to him and then following Jesus of Nazareth. So the very testimony of Paul and his attempt to squash the Christian movement does not explain. The hallucination theory does not explain that.
Because what I take from that you're saying is, if Ed's saying the hallucinations of the disciples came because of a great desire for their Messiah not to have died, that certainly wasn't the case with Paul. He had every reason not to want Jesus to have
resurrected. Not just Paul, Justin, but when you consider the fact that Paul also mentions Jesus appeared to James. James was the brother of Jesus. And one thing we do know about the brothers of Jesus, according to the Gospels, was that they had great deep hostility towards him.
They were very skeptical, yeah.
Very skeptical. But then James becomes the leader of the early Christian movement. He becomes, if you will, the first bishop of Jerusalem and leads the church in the book of Acts. So the very conversion of James, the Lord's brother, I think is another strong argument.
So you got both the fact that we do have accounts of multiple people experiencing the risen Jesus. Why would they all have had the same experience? Group hallucinations don't happen, really. And the fact that someone like Paul and James had no good reason to kind of have this kind of psychologically induced type of an experience.
I take on board, as you know, that hallucinations only explain individual experiences. And what would have happened, as I imagine it, is if, say, Peter or Mary Magdalene or some of these key central people had these really strong, powerful experiences, then they started telling people, the whole atmosphere would change from one of despair to hope that Jesus is alive again. And just that sense of hope and the new kind of freshness of it would lead on to all sorts of other things. So there's these group visions people have today of Virgin Mary. That's not a hallucination, but it's some kind of known phenomenon that we see fairly often. There's a whole thing with cognitive dissonance, Leon Fessenden's work, actually where he started it with this little sect that was after expecting UFOs to come and rescue them despite the floods that were going to come on the 21st of December 1954, and Leon's group infiltrated them, and then when they stayed in the group and listened and saw how people coped when this flood and UFO visit didn't happen. He wrote it up in that book, When Prophecy Fails, and from that we see how people cover and cope with the disappointment. In this case, it would be the crucifixion would be a disappointment, by taking on stronger beliefs, not backing away from them. Then there's a whole issue of false memories as well. There's a lovely Phil Skydive Phil from our discussion group, and he's been on the show as well. He was saying in the discussion group how there was this trick a magician did, as it was a test to see people how people react. He used conjuring to bend a key, and then he put the key down in the middle of the table with everyone watching and said to the people, look, can you see the key? It's still bending. It's bending more. Look, see how it's bending even more. And then I think a week later or something, the researchers asked the people who witnessed this, and a lot of them said, yes, we did see that key bend. So what I'm saying is that once the belief is there, it can grow and it can grow. So I imagine, say, a group of 12 people in the upper room, you know, and there's that sense of expectancy, and they have religious experiences, but who knows what. And then in the telling, it becomes, oh, Jesus was physically there, even
right.
though...
Right, so it's sort of, like you say, urban myths and exaggeration and a bit of, you know...
Yes, it's like a big... I've got, like, a menu of mistakes.
Yes, you have. I mean, that, and quite a few that you've outlined there, different reasons why you think this would have... kind of happened. Okay, Tony, some responses to some of those various
reasons. I mean, in the case of the magician, you need a magician there to perform the act. So the magician has to be there to persuade the people. And it's not the people that imagine the magician in the case that Ed is citing. And so, again, in the group appearances where Jesus is seen by 500 people, this does not explain a hallucination. As I pointed out, who is the one who is persuading all these 500 people that Jesus is alive and he's going to show up right now in front of us? He's going to give us the Great Commission. I mean, I think, in my opinion, Ed has not proven in this particular case beyond a reasonable doubt that hallucination theory does explain what we see. The other problem, again, and we still have not answered that question, is even if there was a hallucination, let's say they assume that they saw Jesus alive again, they certainly would not be referring to Jesus as the resurrected Christ, because the one sure way to defeat any resurrection claim is to produce the body. And that's exactly what the religious authorities never were able to do. And so to say that Jesus simply appeared after his death, they would not be obliged to use the language of resurrection. And so psychoanalysis is a very difficult area. I mean, it's difficult to assess people today in the 21st century, much less the first century.
Okay, we're drawing to a close, gentlemen. We've had a lot of time to go around this. Tony obviously doesn't feel that the hallucination hypothesis really gets off the ground, whereas you feel it's a strong contender. Alongside other things. Maybe just to finish off, Ed, if the evidence from the minimal facts isn't enough for you, what would it take to convince you of the resurrection? I have heard some atheists, and I don't know if you'd agree with them, say, well, it would be nothing less than a videotape at the scene that would convince me. Obviously, that's not something that could ever be provided. But I don't know, what is there a sort of a criterion which point you would be satisfied to say yes, a miracle happened?
Certainly if but it would need to be more than beyond reasonable doubt, but there would need to be a really good evidence that would convince me. So the kind of thing I have in mind would be a document written by people hostile to the whole story that verified these key facts. If these five facts could be verified, say, with if a document was found written by a Roman governor's clerk or something, who Pilate's clerk, who reported these things, and that was a clear, established right. document, then that would really be, that would begin to establish it beyond reasonable doubt.
I mean, your view is, I guess, Tony, that we do have those sorts of documents. Maybe we don't have a kind of smoking gun. Absolutely, that ticks every box that Ed wants. But for you, there's enough kind of corroborative material to say, well, these facts are established.
Yes, I would say so. Now, we don't have anything that I could date to the first century, but early second century, we have the writings of Porphyry, who was a Christian and then apostatized, and he went out trying to disprove, interestingly enough, the Christian faith in some ways that Ed has tried to argue. And also, we do know of Celsus, who also Origen records his attacks and polemics on the Christian faith using similar arguments as well. So there were opposing voices. I mean, they're not from the first century, but they do come from the early second century, and they did challenge the Christian faith on some similar grounds. So we do have some enemies of the faith challenging these ideas. But speaking as a theologian, I think the problem here is not. I think that even if someone was to see a resurrection, that would not be enough to convince them. Jesus performed many signs and miracles in his ministry. That was not enough to convince people. The raising of Lazarus did not convince people, except for a few. I think the problem ultimately, from a spiritual point of view, I think the problem is a spiritual deadness in our hearts that only God can heal and revive.
Well, that could be a subject for another day, but it's been really interesting having you both interact on the evidence side of things today. So thank you very much. Thank you for round two, as it were, take two on this particular discussion. Appreciate you coming on, Tony, getting up early
thank
in the
you.
Morning in Toronto to be
yes.
with me. If people want to find out more about you, where should I send them online?
Well, they can go to my website, tonycosta.webs.com. That's Tony Costa, all one word, .webs.com.
Ed, if people want to find out more about the Unbelievable discussion group that you've set up, what's the easiest place to send them to?
Well, I guess Google Meetup, Unbelievable. and
you should find it that way. Yeah, Unbelievable yeah. Meetup London. Yeah, and that London, kind of stuff. Yep. We'll get you to it. We wouldn't want to send you to the one in LA or somewhere else. I don't think they exist anywhere else as yet, but who knows? For the moment, thank you very much for being with me too, Ed. It's been great to have you on. Thanks for grilling Tony with lots of questions this afternoon. And thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed today's discussion. Perhaps it's generated a few questions of your own. Why not email them in? I'll give you the ways to get in touch again in just a moment's time. Thanks for listening to today's edition of Unbelievable.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, I hope you'll think about getting in touch with me about what you heard on the programme today. If you're interested in doing so, it's unbelievable@premier.org.uk to send me an email. Or you can tweet me at unbelievablejb. Let me know what you thought by Twitter. Facebook.com/unbelievablejb to follow the show on Facebook. And I regularly post other stuff as well, apart from the show on there that gets people talking. So all of those links and more available from the show website. You can also leave a comment underneath the latest edition of the programme. PremierChristianRadio.com/unbelievable. Now, excuse the slightly croaky voice on the programme today. Just coming out of a little bit of a cold, that time of year, isn't it, when these things come and go. But it won't stop me from reading out some of the feedback that's come in. Loads of feedback, in fact, to last week's programme. Really fun, interesting dialogue between Jim Al-Khalili, who's a scientist, broadcaster and president of the British Humanist Association, in conversation with Alistair McGrath, a theologian, former scientist himself, about the book Inventing the Universe by Alistair. Lots of people appreciated that discussion. Tim in Kobe, Japan says another really enjoyable show. Such an interesting and civil dialogue. When discussing whether maths is discovered or invented, Jill Al-Khalili mentioned that it was an interesting question whether pi was kind of floating around waiting to be discovered. I couldn't help but think this was another kind of pie in the sky, except this pie in the sky isn't bye-bye like that other kind of pie. It's eternal from the past. At least that's how I view it. Numbers and values such as pi aren't necessarily existing entities, much like God, in the sense they aren't contingent on anything else, but they're very much unlike God in that they have no causal powers of any kind. It would be interesting to explore that in more depth. You also go on to talk about Occam's razor. As a devout Christian myself, and the way that was employed by Jim. As a devout Christian himself, I wonder if William of Ockham turns over in his grave when his namesake is used that way. After all, if you're simply going for the simplest solution to, for instance, the origin of the universe, what is simpler than God did it? God is supposedly complicated, while some unknown and really unknowable entity existing in something that is totally outside the universe is supposedly simple. Thank you very much, Tim. Here is Norman. Norman's an atheist. He's been on the show before, in fact. Norman Backrack says, unfortunately, Jim Al-Khalili is not as clever at philosophical arguments as crafty Alistair. Jim himself would probably agree he's a bit of a novice at it, having specialised in physics. I have 4 points, which, in my opinion, he could have made a stronger case for humanism. First, is there meaning to the universe? Well, although Jim hesitantly said no, he could have asked Alistair, what is then the purpose of the universe and why was it designed to have pain, suffering, etc. in it? Secondly, McGrath said that secular humanism is the correct description of today's humanism, and Al-Khalili seemed to agree. But since humanism means concern with this life rather than a possible next world, and secular means this world or time-bound as opposed to eternity, talk of secular humanism is a tautology. McGrath said God is simple, and again, Alistair, Al-Khalili had nothing to say. How can mind that can create and then calculate to infinite precision the future position and velocities of every particle in the universe for a duration of 14 billion years possibly be simple? Yet this is what Alistair McGrath believes. And finally, the applicability of maths is said by Alistair McGrath to be a mystery. But as there are an infinite number of mathematical theories, one of them is bound to be the description of this world, and an infinite number are false, i.e. not applicable to this universe. That's Norman's explanation for why there is this uncanny ability of maths to map onto our universe. Here's Dave from Litchfield in Staffordshire says, thanks for the fascinating discussion. I must say, I expected more of a battle from Jim, and I reckon that you, Justin, were half expecting to convert the man. I see faith and science as two sides of the same coin. Faith is the evidence of things unseen, Hebrews 11. Faith carries a form of evidence, but it's a type that isn't necessarily measurable, whereas science produces evidence of things that are measurable and quantifiable. Each on their own are inadequate in some respects, aspects to discern truth, but together they are an effective means of determining the truth that permeates the universe. At any rate, various experiments in the quantum field, such as the double slit experiment, suggest that consciousness is embedded within the universe and is essential to its existence. Might one of these consciousnesses be described as God? Keep up the good work. Look forward to the next one. Thank you, Dave. Here's Carl, who says, I know this is overlong. I hope you'll understand why by the time you get to the meat of it. We're all familiar with scientists and atheists making much capital and indeed some furthering their careers, taking pot shots at the Bible as if what they had to say was somehow relevant. The reason they do so and that they get away with it is they assume a great deal of confidence for their own positions. It's time the tables were turned and the paucity of their own thought revealed. We assume, for instance, that everything they say comes from a position of evidence, facts and experimentation. Actually, nothing new has appeared in physics since the early 1980s, nothing that is backed up with evidence. Everything else is sheer speculation and metaphysics. So while we all know the words like black holes, dark matter, the multiverse, space-time, the Big Bang, as well as notions of the microwave, background radiation, gravity waves and gravitons, hardly anyone is aware that there's not the slightest shred of evidence for any of them. What evidence there might have been, like light bending near heavy masses, has been discredited in more recent times. Indeed, the fact that science is in crisis is because this is kept very quiet for fear of loss of confidence. And I'm afraid I am going to skip over some of the aspects of your email to the final part here, Carl, where you say, so really it's high time tables were turned. Science has become a religion because their concepts require an acceptance as an act of faith that certain knowledge is all there is. There can be no more pernicious an idea than the multiverse, which only exists to bolster the belief in stipticism, as you call it. That is a soulless reality. Thank you very much for getting in touch. Here's Mark in Aliso Viejo, California. Says, I go to the gym twice a week. Always listen to the Unbelievable podcast. Maybe you should do two shows a week. But then I suppose I wouldn't catch up on past episodes. And frankly, I wouldn't have time to do that, Mark. Thank you for the suggestion, though. Really like the spirit of the conversation between Alistair and Jim. I respect them both for their willingness to engage in a meaningful conversation without the usual confrontational style. One thing that strikes me as missing in most of these conversations is the concept of theory. No one really knows how the universe began or how humans came to be. What we have is theories. The theory of evolution is far from confirmed in any scientific sense, for instance. Why does science feel the need to expel another theory that doesn't agree with what most believe to be true? SETI, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, is considered science. Who's to say that ETs aren't the designers in the intelligent design debate? Why is that door closed? How can any theory not proven wrong be so easily dismissed? Interesting you mentioned that, Mark. We're discussing exactly that kind of thing next week on the programme, so listen out for that. Now, I do believe God is the designer, but I'm open to whatever is true. I wouldn't affect my faith at all if evolution were to be proven, but I would ask the question, where does life itself come from? Okay, thank you. Here's one from Gerard Zimmerman, who is an MSc in mathematics, says, can we please put to rest this notion that the surprising effectiveness of mathematics in describing the natural world is some kind of indication of design? This argument keeps coming up from design supporters and sadly some more agnostic people, and I think it needs to be addressed. First of all, mathematics in the past was primarily motivated by real-world problems and attempts to solve them. Whether it was gambling or land surveying or finances, the mathematics that was developed to answer those types of questions was searched out and developed specifically. Secondly, mathematics is good at building models or approximations of real-world scenarios, but many of them are admittedly rough generalizations of the real world. Mathematics is not actually that good at explaining the real world. Most people who get enamored with the notion that mathematics has some kind of mystical ability to describe the real world have never actually tried to model a real-world situation. Find a mathematical model for the population of rabbits in the UK since 1800. It's complicated and difficult, and whatever you come up with will only be a generally good approximation within certain boundary conditions and assumptions. Thirdly, there's a great amount of pure or abstract mathematics that has nothing to do with the real world at all. I find the Goldbach conjecture compelling and intriguing, but it models nothing and means nothing, so far at least, in the real world. And finally, some of the great results in mathematics are never ever going to give you anything but an approximate answer in the real world. This is different from my second point, which addresses formulas which attempt to model the real world. Here I'm talking about pure mathematical formulas, which can only be approximately applied. And you finish by saying, Gerard, the universe is a messy place. Some mathematics is pretty good at approximately modelling aspects of the real world, but that's only because people spend years and years working on the models and equations. Gerard, I hesitate to take issue with you, as you are a mathematician yourself, obviously, but I've heard it from enough other mathematicians and physicists who do take the view that there is an an uncanny applicability of mathematics to the universe we live in. And so I think, who was it, Eugene Wigner, who originally coined that phrase, as it were, the unusual effectiveness of mathematics. So I don't know. I think other people would beg to disagree with you and say that there is something extraordinary about the way the laws and mathematics that we're able to come up with map so fruitfully onto the world. And when you say, there's lots of pure and abstract mathematics that has nothing to do with the real world at all, I'm sure there is. But isn't it the case that some of those apparently abstract mathematical notions have then been found to be employed in real world situations, where suddenly we see them spring to life in a real world capacity? But anyway, thank you for being a loyal listener, as you've signed yourself off there. Just quick ones as well from Jeff in Hillsborough, Ohio. You've put together a wonderful show, as always. I'm in the middle of listening to it for the third time. No references to flying spaghetti monsters or even a hint of disdain for the other's conclusions. This was a very good and helpful discussion. And Avril says, really interesting. Liked very much both Alistair and Jim. As a believer, it's helpful to consider the arguments. I loved Alistair's response. Believing only inspires him to understand more of the bigger map. That's so encouraging. And good to hear the president of the British Humanists, open and not closed. Thanks so much, Justin. Well, thank you, Avril, and all the others who got in touch about last week's programme. We're just about out of time, unfortunately, for today's programme, so thanks for being with me. Don't forget, of course, that you can get in touch as well on Facebook and Twitter. Lots of other people did that and said that they enjoyed last week's programme as well. Some also, critiquing Jim not putting up, a more thorough defence of humanism. James Croft, I think, was one of the tweeters to me in the last week, suggesting that maybe we ought to revisit that subject, and he'd be happy to debate it. Maybe we will. But in any case, thanks very much for being with me on the programme today, the programme that aims to get you thinking. And I do hope you'll stick around here on Premier Christian Radio for The Profile, which comes next. But for the moment, I'll tell you what's coming up on next week's show.
You're unbelievable.
We're going to be asking whether God is the best explanation for apparent design in biology. Yes, we're talking about intelligent design next week. Jonathan McClatchy joins me. He's become a leading voice in the intelligent design community. He's a PhD biologist himself. And he'll be in discussion with Corey Markham. He's one of the bloggers at Atheist Republic. It's a large and well-used atheist website. And he's going to be having a crack at debating intelligent design with Jonathan. So come back for that at the same time next week. And I do hope you have a great week until then.